Thank you for listening. This is the Legends Podcast by All Day Vinyl, and I'm your host, Scott Duddleson. After you finish this episode, please subscribe, rate, and check us out on Instagram and YouTube at All Day Vinyl. Today, I'm excited to speak with an ace guitar player, a songwriter, and 2015 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee. While my guest is best known as a member of Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, playing guitar and co-writing on key albums, including I Love Rock and Roll and Up Your Alley, he's also carved out a career as a solo artist, and through his extensive work as a mental health and recovery advocate, has been dubbed a recovery troubadour, a subject we're going to talk about. I'm pleased to introduce to you Ricky Bird. Ricky, thank you.
How's you doing, Scott? Joining.
Appreciate having you here. Let's start with the new, and we'll take it back, because the new is very fascinating, and I think it does connect very closely with your history. So you released a song earlier this year called Rhapsody in Blues, which is a tribute to Jeff Beck. I know Jeff is one of your early heroes. So tell me about both the song, why this tribute, and if you have any history with Jeff.
I mean, I met him a couple of times, no history beyond that. But so I'm signed to Wicked Cool Records. Let's take it back to that.
Yeah.
And, you know, at first I said to Steven Van Zandt, and that's his label, I said, I just want to put out singles. You know, I don't see the point of putting out full records at this, you know. Because you get radio, if you're lucky enough to get radio, they play one or two songs, and you got like 10 songs on there or 12 songs. So, yeah, he said, sounds great. I said, yeah, I want to be like Tommy James. Let's just put out singles like it's 1965. So we put out in 2023, the first one was called Glamdemic Blues, right? And that I wrote, obviously, it's as the title says, I wrote that during the COVID lockdown. Just very glam, you know, the music is very glam. Lyrics are all about like, you know, just give me one Saturday night, just one Saturday night, you know. Second one came out 2 months or 3 months after that called Alien. Once again, very glamish, that my influence that come from 1973, 73, 74. And that song is basically, and I told Van Zandt this, I had watched The Day the Earth Stood Still on TCM. And I had a dream that night that I was in a sort of like an interrogation room with 3-4 aliens, but right out of Central Casting aliens. And Van Zandt was there. See, he was sitting at the table with me. And I told him, I don't remember if you were Silvio Dante or if you were Van Zandt, but I was trying to buy the earth more time. See, and he was sort of the, you know, he was the middleman. And then I woke up and I wrote the song Alien, you know, and that was the second song. Then about 3 months later, we're in 2023. And meanwhile, I'm working on more songs as these songs come out. Comes Luann, straight up rock and roll song, sort of like a Jerry Lee Lewis, you know, kind of thing, Little Richard. That's the only song that has lyrics that lean towards a recovery narrative, like my previous two records that I put out. And so that was that one. And then we lost Jeff, which was horrible. And I guess it came out of nowhere. It wasn't like one of those, you know, rock and roll cats, like you thought this news was going to come at some point. He was not that guy, really.
Yeah. He was touring too, up until, yeah, you know, last year. Absolutely.
And he was a big influence on me when I was a kid, you know, when I was 14, the Truth record, all that stuff. You know, the stuff with Rod Stewart. And then later, you know, when he did the solo stuff, he got a little bit more progressive. Kind of lost me there for a few years when it got very progressive. But I was always listening to him and stealing little licks. Not that anybody could play Jeff Beck licks, but I did the best I could. So he was always part of my lexicon, you know, in rock and roll.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I just had to write something. I don't know what made me do it. And I wanted to do an instrumental. It was the first instrumental I've ever written, which is interesting. And it's not just music with no lyrics. You actually have to make it interesting.
Yeah.
And you have to come up with a theme. The melody has to be an interesting to carry the song. So we cut that, Rhapsody in Blues. And I'm a Gershwin fan, so I thought that was a clever title. And that's it. It was just me nodding to Jeff Beck. You know, it's just, I wasn't trying to play like Jeff Beck. I wasn't trying to, you know, there are a couple of riffs on there that are Jeff Beck-esque, But other than that, that's, you know, that's my guitar playing, and I just wanted to throw a couple of his licks in there to say, yeah, this is a tribute to you, brother. That's so great. We did a video for it. And all of these songs have been played quite a bit on Little Steven's Underground Garage.
I've heard them on there. Absolutely.
Thank you. Good. That's good. A kick too. That's one of the biggest kicks when I'm driving in my car by myself, you know, and it comes on. But we did a video for it maybe a month and a half ago, and we're going to save it for the album, which brings me back to that conversation. So I'm writing. Now all of a sudden I got like 9 songs, 10 songs. And I say to Van Zandt, I guess this is a record. This is going to full length. So I'm at the tail end. I could see the finish line. We just cut, as far as drummers, I used Steve Holly.
Who's
played with Joe Cocker, played with Ian Hunter for a long time.
Phenomenal.
And then Aaron Comis from the Spin Doctors. Tommy Price played on a track too. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what's going to wind up on the record. I cut 15 songs. And Aaron and myself and Bob Stand are my co-producer. We do it out at a place called Parcheesi Studios out in Long Island here in New York, which is Bob's studio. And we just cut the last 2 tracks. I mean, we cut the, because I don't have a band, see, the process is I go in and I play guitar to a click track, and then we start piling stuff on because I just don't have a band. And it's always Jeff Kazee on keyboards. Jeff, I met when I played with the Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes for a year and change. Bob plays bass, amazing bass player and guitar player. Obviously, all the guitars are mine. And all the vocals are mine. I try to get, because it's so far out in Long Island, I wind up doing a lot of the backgrounds myself, which Steven can't stand. In fact, on the 2 songs we just worked on, he had me come into the Wicked Cool office and had a bunch of, I think I'm going to call them the Baba Black Sheep Singers because of this part they sang, the background. So it was Willie Nile. Mark Ribbler, who is a great guitar player, plays. He's Steven's musical director for the Disciples of Soul. Who else was it? Jeff Kazee and Steven. So they sang. Steven wanted to put other voices on there. He said some of the songs, you know, it's not that important. You can't really notice. You can't tell it's all me. Not that there aren't very famous records out that the lead singer sang all the backgrounds too.
Sure.
But he wanted to throw some other stuff up there. So that we just did that last month. And we're getting close, you know. This is April. I'm trying to finish it by the end of April and hand it in.
I can't wait to hear it. I mean, you've got a unique rock and roll sound that's even carried when you were doing the recovery records, and now you're doing these rock records. And from what I gather, what I've, you know, read about you and heard, you know, this harkens back to the early influences when you saw Beatles on Sullivan, and ultimately saw the Rolling Stones and thought that was, you know, that was dangerous, that was dirty. So I want to go back a little to those times. How were you finding this music that was coming in from England before it was, you know, for those internet?
Oh, that's easy. So I started off, I got my first guitar when I was 9, and that was after seeing this Beatles and the Stones on Ed Sullivan. Just like everybody in my demographic will tell you the same story.
Yeah.
And then we moved from the Bronx. I grew up in the Bronx. We moved to Queens. And then that was my first experience with playing with other people. And some of the guys that I met, which I'm still friends with to this day. In fact, we played Flushing High School, 1973. It's pretty much the first big concert I played, right? And we were doing, because, you know, you would play church dances. You put together little bands, right? Garage bands. I'm like 16, and we would play back then. So if you play a dance, you'd play Midnight Hour, you know, I don't know. Rascals with Good Lovin', stuff, Land of a Thousand Dances, that kind of stuff. These guys that I met, there were a couple of parks out here when we moved to Queens that had live concerts in the summer. And I met this little group of guys, musicians, at one of these parks. It might have been Alley Pond Park or Croshorn Park. And we became friends, and we put together a band. But they had already been to England a couple of times. They were a couple of, like, they're maybe, I'm 16, they were 18. They had already traveled to England. So they came back with the clothes, first off, right? The velvet suits, you know, the snakeskin boots, the velvet suits and the snakeskin boots. Oh, wait a minute, there's a lyric, hold on. And they turned me on to stuff that I wasn't listening to yet. A lot of the British stuff. Now, a lot of it also had to do with when radio changed from transistor radio, AM, Tommy James, Al Green, you know, New York radio stations. They would play everything on one station, to FM, which they would play album sides. And, you know, you were just a kid and you would have your headphones on. You'd be just laying there, you know, and just listening to like Rock and the Fillmore, Humble Pie, and, you know, Foghat and Slade, you know. I mean, all the bit, Rod Stewart and the Faces. And they turned me on to a lot of stuff that I didn't know about yet. So that was really my intro to that music. Now, my intro to the blues happened from all the magazines that I read when I was a kid, where you'd see Keith Richards talking about Muddy Waters or Howlin' Wolf or, you know, Chuck Berry. Chuck Berry, we heard on that AM radio. Actually, probably back then it was My Ding-a-Ling was probably the single that came out, because the other stuff was in the 50s, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was just a little bastard at that point. But then you'd start going to find blues records. So it was basically from musicians that I listened to when I would read articles. They sent me to find the blues stuff, which now we do, my age.
Yeah.
When you do stuff, I turn other kids that are younger than me on to, oh, have you ever heard Spooky Tooth? Or, oh, you got to check out, they did a version of I Am the Walrus, or, you know, yeah, stuff like that. So it's, it just all goes around, keeps going around in a big circle. Absolutely. And that's really, that's how I started to listen to that stuff. And I found stuff, and I loved everything. I wasn't into prog rock. I mean, yeah, I had Yes albums. I had the Yes Fragile record. It wasn't my favorite stuff, though. I like the Jay Giles Band. Yeah. I love Slade. We saw Slade a couple of times. Mountain. Leslie became a friend of mine. There was a place here in New York called the Academy of Music on 14th Street. And back in the 20s, it was a vaudeville house. So I was a little young for the Fillmore. I saw a couple of shows at the Fillmore. But when I was at the age to be able to go to concerts, 14, you know, something like that, it was the Academy of Music. It was the concert hall. And it was two shows, you know, 8 and 11. And it was like $250 for a ticket or something. And it was three acts, right? So it was Jay Giles, Humble Pie, and Mountain. You know, I'm making that up, but it probably happened.
Sure, totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
And so that was it for me. That was my introduction to stuff.
At what point did you start taking those influences, writing your own songs, and start playing more, I don't want to say professionally, but at least in the clubs beyond the high schools or beyond?
So New York was fabulous at that time. There was this underground subculture, let's call it rock and roll, glam, glitter. There were a few clubs. There was Max's Kansas City, famous club. That's where I made my bones, right, as a kid, getting in there. That's with funny.
Tell me about Max's. That's a legendary, infamous.
Yeah, well, before me, when I started going there, it was sort of, they catered to the artists, see, and Mickey Ruskin, who owned the place, scrappy looking guy, right, stand at the front door. He was he was somebody that loved artists and loved to support artists. So if they couldn't, they would come in for lunch or early dinner, the artists, and they couldn't pay, they would give him pieces of art. That's the art that hung on the walls. Very when cool. I started going there, it just became the place. So if Zeppelin was playing at the Garden, you knew Zeppelin was going to wind up at Max's Kansas City later that night. And if Led Zeppelin was going to be at Max's Kansas City, there'd be some girls at Max's Kansas City, you know. So me and my friends used to come in from Queens at that point, and we would go hang out there. Later on, we'd start playing there, because downstairs was the bar, and we would eat dinner, the famous chickpeas that they had on the table that wound up being thrown later at the night. And there was the back room. You walked in, there was a long bar, and there was some tables, booths, and then the back room is when somebody famous came in, like David Bowie or Jagger, and they would go in the back, and there would be this big table. One time when Martha Hoople played, they played the Eurus Theater, which I was at the shows. I think the three shows, I was at two of them. Queen opening. It was Queen's first time in America. They all wound up at Max's around this big round table. As soon as you entered the back room, there's a round table. And me and my friends stood around them like little morons staring at them, which you would do, right?
Yeah.
And then 20 years later, I'm playing in Ian Hunter's band, you know, touring Europe and Scandinavia. So there you go. That's how to hopefully.
Do you ever recount that to him? Tell him that you.
Yeah, he knew that. I told him that story right off the bat, you know. Yeah,
that's great.
But everybody, you see everybody there.
Yeah.
If you stood up, you know, I remember seeing Angela and David Bowie walking in matching suits, you know. And so there was Max's, there was the Mercer Arts Center, which was another place that was very artsy, all velvet stuff and mirrors. And it was just, you know, I think it was something else also. So it had a different sort of look to it. That's where like the New York Dolls played.
Right, right.
You know, before Max's, there was a club called Nobody's that was on Bleecker Street that we used to go to, where you would see Jimmy Page. You'd walk in, he'd be sitting at the bar drinking a Remy, you know, like. It was just these just little subculture, these little clubs that the musicians knew when they came to town that they could go and hang out and not be bothered too much. Then I started playing these places, same places. You know, there was a place in Queens called Coventry on Queens Boulevard where Kiss played with before the makeup, you know, and my bands would play there. I was 16, man, but we would mix up some originals with some free. I mean, my friend Phil, who I'm talking about, was one of those guys that we played Flushing in high school. He sent me a tape of us rehearsing in a storefront doing a free song. I'm trying to think of which one it was. Wishing Well, mm-hmm. With me singing in this little storefront on the boulevard, you know. So we were way different than a lot of the other bands. If we were playing cover stuff, we were doing Savoy Brown, Humble Pie. Yeah, Flushing High School, we opened up with 4 Day Creep from the Rock and the Fillmore record. And remember, I'm 16.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Too young to drink. And
but I was playing, but British. I was turned on to the. Yes, exactly.
Totally.
Now, did I like American music? Yeah. I mean, I loved the Jay Giles band.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Please put them in the Rock Hall. You know.
Amen.
And Mountain, I loved. I loved Creedence. I loved Cactus.
Hmm.
I love Cactus.
Carmen Atpiece on drums.
Yeah, Tim Bogart.
We'll both later play with Jeff Beck in the.
Yes, exactly. That's right. And Jim McCarty on guitar,
mm-hmm.
who played with Mitch Ryder.
Yep.
You know, there was a song called Parchment's Farm, an old blues song that Cactus did. And I can't tell you how many hours I tried to learn that break. Everybody should go YouTube Cactus doing Parchment's Farm. And it was very fast. And I was trying to learn the break, so over and scratch the record, just trying over and over again. That was my beginnings, you know, New York City. And because it was a subculture, it was the New York Dolls. They were like this huge band in Max's Kansas City. They were like the rock stars when they came in, you know. Yeah. And we would just hang, and then we would try to do our own stuff. And then we would play, like I said, church dances. Maybe there was one or two clubs in Queens that were like, you know, most places wanted you to do cover stuff. You know, but you could find one or two maybe that you could do some original music, or you'd have to mix it up.
Let me ask you, being young in this incredible fast scene, drugs and alcohol were obviously a part in that. I'm curious, where in your journey did that, because obviously the recovery is a major part of your story. So the beginning of it, where does that come into your world?
Well, I mean, I started smoking pot when I was 13. And because I have the addictive personality trait, which got worse as I got older, when we smoked one joint and everybody else wanted to go home and do their homework, I was like, why don't we smoke another one? You know, more, addicted to more, right? But as soon as you started doing that stuff with the bands and garage bands, you know, somebody would bring over a six pack, or we were teenagers, right? There were certain drugs that were around then, Quaaludes. You know, there were certain pills. And I started out drinking beer. And then when I started hanging out in the city at these clubs, then I you know, I don't think I ever said no to anything anybody offered me, but to my detriment. But I started drinking Southern Comfort at first, I think. And that was disgusting. But, you know, I drank it because Janis Joplin liked it. And then, of course, I switched over to Jack Daniels because my two favorites, Keith and Frank Sinatra, that was their drink, right? But you could see it starts to progress, right? If you have that, what I have,
right,
addictive behavior, you would do more, You were just doing, you know, I'm on the high, one more will get me higher.
And this is,
and then it started turning into a nightmare in the late 70s when cocaine showed its face. It's cocaine's always been around, but it went through different class systems, right? It's in the 20s, it might have been jazz musicians and maybe the highbrow people, the socialites, you know, went to Hollywood, you know, it kept changing places. And then it became part of the rock business at a certain point. It was probably always there, but it became a thing in the late 70s, I would say, you know, to me. And then that's where it was accessible. And then I started doing that.
Hindsight is obviously always 20/20, but at the time, did it feel like, not just with you, but in the surroundings, that the drugs were part of the creative process and part of that outlet? Or was there recognition that it was?
I don't think I was that deep to think it was part of the creative process, but it was part of the rock and roll world that I read about in those magazines. So if you wanted to be one of those guys, well, those girls, when you were, you know, 16, you were just, it was just like follow the bouncing ball, right?
Right, right, yeah.
You know, and not everybody did drugs and booze, but probably the majority at that time. And did it lead to some great songwriting? Yeah, it must have. You know, a lot of Beatles stuff, a lot of Stone stuff. My favorite songs were written like that. That doesn't mean it can't be written without it, and it certainly doesn't, because I'm doing some of my best stuff now.
That's
And I used until 87. So I've been sober. I've been in recovery for 36 years now.
And it
got worse as it got worse as it got along when you started mixing. You become professional chemists. You know, like if I do this and then I take some of that, well, this will put me to sleep, but I'll do this to wake me up, and then this will keep me going through the night.
I have some questions on that in a bit, but I want to make a point, highlight a point you just made, which is, you know, a lot of famous celebrities and musicians were doing drugs, and that's what you want to emulate. And what was not being celebrated at the time, which is being celebrated now, is sobriety.
Right.
Those few that were sober, nobody was writing about how awesome that is and then what a model they are. It was always about the antics. So,
and there are one or two people from back then.
Of course. Yeah.
That did not ever pick up a drink or a
that's
drug.
Right.
You know,
right.
But I think it's safe to say the majority of people did. You know, and now it's probably turned around.
Yeah, we have definitely more resources, and you're a big part of, you know, pushing that forward. And
yeah, I mean, I try to spread the word. I've done some music cares who I'm friends with. I did facilitated a couple of songwriter groups for them here in New York with people that just got into recovery. Some of them you knew, some of them were, you know, newcomers to the business. And their main problem was they couldn't remember. They couldn't write now that they're in recovery. They were questioning if they still could write. Did they lose their edge?
Mm.
I'm here to tell you, you don't lose your edge. You know, in fact, you remember your edge. You know, you remember what you do. And I mean, only for me, speaking for myself, I've never played this well. I've never written this well. I've never sang this well. Was I rocking back then? Yeah, of course I was rocking. I've always been a good guitar player. I know what I'm doing, but now I think I've come into my own as all of those things.
Yeah, I don't think I've heard anybody who's made that transition in recovery say that it was better before. I mean,
No, and I'm never going to say I didn't have a good time. I mean, there were some disastrous things. I mean, I almost died. Literally almost died.
What was, if you don't mind sharing, what was that?
I was out with Joan. We were playing Alabama. I was experimenting with smoking coke, and I think that I smoked tons of pot, so that my lungs were not healthy anyway by the time I was 13. But I did love weed, and if anything, that's the only thing I miss at this point. You know, just watch a Yankee game and take a few hits, but obviously I can't.
Yeah,
but yeah, I think I wound up putting a hole in my lung, so it collapsed on the road, and I wound up in a hospital in Alabama, and it was very serious, and it was closer than they told me. I found out years later how bad it was.
That
didn't stop me, by the way. That was in 83.
I was going to ask.
No, let's kept going until 87.
Let's take a step back, going back to New York and the late 70s, CBGBs and that era. You were in a couple bands. and you had a stint where you were playing with Steve Marriott. Is that right?
I never played in a band with them, but we became friends. We became really good friends. And, you know, just a sidebar here.
Yeah.
CBGBs came a little later, you know, when the Ramones started. I mean, later from Nobody's, that club. Yes. That wasn't a music club. It was a bar, but I wasn't really a CB's guy. Like I've been there. I went there. I played there, but I was a Max's Kansas City guy. Mm-hmm. Like CB's was more of a punk alternative. I was more of Faces, you know, Exile on Main Street.
Yeah. Rockers.
Yeah. Rock and roll.
Yeah.
So I didn't stay. I wasn't a lot at CBGB's, but I played there with Joan. You know, I played there with my bands.
Is that where you first saw Joan?
I saw the Runaways. Yeah.
Was that at CBGB?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
What's your recollection of that?
God, it was so long ago. I don't remember. I mean, I remember me and my friends went, probably the same friends. We went to see an old girl band, you know, it was like, what is this? You know, and it was rocking, you know, it was cool. Joan was great. So. Yeah. You know, thumbs up.
Fortuitous. Years later, you would end up connecting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was almost we went because we heard about them. We read about them. We wanted to see what this was, right? We wanted to see what it was. Because I didn't hear a lot of them on the radio.
Right.
So I wanted to see, me and my friends wanted to see what this band was, this old girl band. And they were great.
Yeah, the mythology and the legend is incredible. And before we get to Joan and you linking up with her, I want to quickly, Steve Marriott is a personal hero of mine as well. Music he did with the Small Faces and Humble Pie. And I'm curious, at the time you linked up with him, what phase of his career was he in? Was that post Humble Pie while he was doing his solo?
Oh, yeah. He still had versions of Humble Pie.
Yeah. Right.
I met him when the last Humble Pie record, Go for the Throat, I think it was.
Yeah.
But Carol, my wife, Carol Kay, is a publicist. She worked at Lieber Krebs as a publicist. Lieber Krebs was a very famous management company. Aerosmith, Nugent, Def Leppard, on and on. Humble Pie.
Yep.
Later, this is way past the Rock and the Fillmore. And so Go for the Throat, that was Steve, Bobby Tench, who just passed away, also played with Jeff Beck. See, everything's connected.
Mm-hmm.
And Sooty Jones and Jerry Shirley on drums.
Right.
That was when I met Steve. They lived, him and Pam, his wife, and their kid, Toby, who's like this grown-up guitar player now. They had an apartment in the Village. So we spent a lot of time hanging out there. And also, you know, when me and Carol would have a fight, I would go stay with Steve and Pam.
Wild.
And we became really good friends. And I could close my eyes and see Steve and me on the couch with guitars and him singing full voice, like Rock and the Fillmore voice in my ear. You know, and teaching me how to sing, like telling me, man, you gotta sing from down here, you know. And funny enough, he had his guitars under the bed was probably the guitar he used on Rock and the Fillmore, not in a case, just thrown under the bed, or one of those guitars that he was famous for. But we were looking through, I don't know, his closet was open. I said, oh man, where'd you get these shoes? He says, oh, take them, man. So what's the history? He said, I wore them on Top of the Pops with the Small Faces when we did Ichigo Park or something. So I still have those.
Wild.
I tried to wear them, but his feet were a lot smaller than mine. He was a little guy. But we hung out a lot. We hung out a lot. I had some really interesting times together. We got high too a lot.
Yeah, he was apparently around that time he was a pretty wild dude. Is that right?
He told me this was my first sort of notice on the wall. We were sitting, he had, after Humble Pie, he put together his bands. One was called Packet of Three. And they played a place here that was another famous club called the Cat Club in New York. So the bus was parked outside. I was sitting on the bus with Steve, and we were doing blow. I guess at this point, it doesn't matter. And I kept taking that back to do more. And he said, you know, you should cut down on that stuff, mate. And then in my brain just went, oh, that's not a good sign. You know. And I'll never forget that. That was the first notice on the wall that maybe I was going too far. But I loved him. He was great. He was my favorite singer. You know, him, Paul Rogers, Terry Reid.
Yeah.
You know, that's the singer. Of course, Rod. Mm-hmm. Those are the singers that really, you know, put a run in my stocking, as they say, when I was a teenager. listening to that stuff.
Absolutely.
And sure. And you know, we saw Paul Rogers. I think Carol's doing his publicity. They were playing at BB King's in Times Square, and we went to see him. And dude, he started singing, and I got all teary because his voice was just as strong as it was when he was that kid in Free. Yeah. And I've had a chance. I was in a band with Simon Kirk. We've done events together, you know. So I've done All Right Now plenty of times, and yeah, those I've had. That's one thing. And another sidebar is like through my career, I've been lucky enough to play with a lot of these people that I spun their vinyl when I was a kid.
Yeah, incredible.
You know, I've had a chance to play Mississippi Queen with Leslie West and be his pal. And, you know, I never played on stage with Steve, but we played plenty of stuff in his apartment. And of course, jumping around, the stuff that I do most of now, more before, I still do them now, but before COVID, there's this crew of us that are like, you know, Will Lee, Liberty DeVito from Billy Joel's band, Jeff Carlisi from 38 Special, who else? Rob Osser, who plays with Frampton for the last 25 years, plays with a lot of people. We're like a crew, see? So when there's ever these charity events around the country, they always call us. You know, the substitutes, if somebody can't make it, Paul Schaefer's done them. That's given me the ability to be in this all-star band for 50 events over the last 10 years where I'm backing up Mavis Staples, Brian Wilson, Smokey Robinson, you know, now I can't, Darlene Love.
Amazing.
I mean, you can see it on my Wikipedia page, playing like three songs with Smokey Robinson, you know, playing in my room with Brian Wilson. It's, you know, it's a pretty magnificent career. And I couldn't ask for anything more. I don't have a band, like I said, but I do this new music.
We're gonna get to that. I wanna go back. What allowed you to get to this place was your ultimate meeting with Joan Jett and joining the Blackhearts, which you joined during the I Love Rock and Roll sessions. Is that right?
Yeah. So once again, Carol, so Joan Jett and Kenny Laguna, her manager, they didn't have an office yet, so they were friends with Steve Lieber of Lieber and Krebs, so they would use one of the rooms there as their office. So Carol became friendly with Joan and Kenny. They were looking for a guitar player. Carol said, "Do you want to go down and jam with Joan Jett?" I said, "Yeah, yeah, she's great." And, you know, long story short, I wound up joining the band. They were cutting the I Love Rock and Roll record. We wound up, except for Crimson and Clover and Little Drummer Boy, which were Eric Idle's Monty Python. Yeah. Eric Amble, who's a great guitar player, great producer. You know, I redid all the stuff except for those two songs. He played the break on Crimson. I played rhythm on that. He had left the band. So we kind of redid everything. And then we hit the road. We got into a small, what are they called?
Minivan.
It was bigger than a minivan. You know, it wasn't a tour bus. It was between a tour bus and a minivan.
At that point, did Joan have success from the... I know she put out Bad Reputation.
Well, yeah, she had cult success.
Cult success, right.
Right.
But I Love Rock and Roll is what...
Yeah, I Love Rock and Roll just blew it up.
Yeah. That,
and it happened as we were on the road. So the record comes out. We're playing clubs. All of a sudden, the clubs are packed. Then all of a sudden, we're playing theaters. Then all of a sudden, we're playing stadiums. And we're opening for ZZ Top or The Police or something like that. It literally happened while we were on the road. And every week they would bring the music papers, you know, Billboard, Record World. Was it Record World? What was it called? Yeah. You know, the industry papers, magazines. You could see the rock and roll climbing up the charts. But we were in the middle of this hurricane. A tornado. Let's put it. Let's say a tornado.
Tornado being the tour or the
like we didn't know what was going on. It was just getting bigger.
Yeah.
Oh, all of a sudden we have a proper tour bus.
Yeah.
You know. Then we have two tour buses, and then that's it. And then we traveled the world a couple of times, and we did all those right. But it was very consistent.
Yeah, you guys were always
tour, on. Back, do the second record, go out on tour, come back, do the third. You know, is that.
And you co-wrote a number of songs after I Love Rock and Roll throughout.
Yeah, I think it was like 13 songs.
Yeah, a lot of really great ones. And tell me how you know, because Joan and Kenny were their unit. how did you fit into it, and how did you start the co-writing with them? What was that?
Well, I mean, you know, she was my bandmate. She was like my sister, right? So we were like best friends back then. We were just, some of it was off the road, like a session. Okay, we're going to meet out at the studio and we're going to write. And it was just me and John with two guitars. Or it would be in a hotel room. Or, hey, John, I got this idea. Or John would say, hey, what do you think of this? It's just that.
And you've co-written with, you know, a number of really incredible people over the years, Roger Daltrey included, Joan, obviously.
Yes, I did a Roger Daltrey record in 93.
Right, and I want to ask you about that. But really to bring it to now, like when you co-write with the Roger Daltrey, you co-write with the Joan Jett, what's the distinct experience like with each of them and how they process music?
Oh, well, everybody's different. I mean,
when I write my own songs,
It always starts with me on the guitar, which is interesting because somebody just asked me to hook me up with somebody, this artist, to write who doesn't play an instrument. So she's going to send me a melody to a click, and she wants me to put the music behind it, which is the complete opposite of the way I do it. I've never done it that. I've never written music to lyrics. I've always written lyrics and then the music and then the lyrics. So that's going to be a great challenge. So with every single person, everybody has their own process. I mean,
when you're writing with Roger, for example, are you guys coming up with lyrics together? Are you coming up with the melody? Or how does he?
Yeah, I don't remember how that one went. It was Gerard McMahon who produced the record, who's my pal for a long time, brought me in on that record, right, to be the guitar player and the songwriter. And I wound up co-producing one of the tracks too. I can't remember. I think we sat in Gerard's house in the village, the West Village, me, Gerard, and Roger, with acoustic guitars. And we just started doing, and maybe somebody had a title. I mean, it's so different. I mean, the one thing I know when I write, because I had a Sony Music publishing deal for a couple of years, if write with this guy, Scott, he's doing a record, he wants to write with you. Let's go out and have coffee first. You know, I need to sit and let's just do this.
Right.
I can't just sit down. It's not a business to me. Like, yeah, it's a business, but I got to sit down and sort of get, who are you? Like, what kind of song do you want to write? Let's tell some stories and then go. And sometimes the music business gets very just sort of like, well, when I was at Sony, you would go up to their studios to write or record. It was very big building. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's very corporate.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
not organic. Whereas it sounds like with Joan Jett, she's your sister. You're hanging out. You're
right. Eating. With that said, the Brill Building, where all those great songs came from the 50s and the 60s,
yeah,
that was a building also. And they'd be sitting in a room, Neil Sedaka or Neil Diamond or this one or that one or Carole King. Oh, the Temptations are upstairs. They need a song.
Yeah.
You know, so but they still, I guess they still had it. Their room was this writer's room.
Yeah, they had their chemistry. Carole King and Jerry Goffin, they had their thing.
Well, but the difference between when I wrote for Sony from the Brill Building is what I'm saying. The Four Tops are looking for material. When I wrote for Sony, it was just write songs. It was very rare that they said Cher was looking for a song. This one was looking. It was write songs and then let's see if we can get them placed.
Right.
As opposed to writing for a specific artist. And when you write for a specific artist, you got to get in their head a little bit because we're not writing a Ricky Bird song. We're writing a Roger Daltrey song.
Right.
I'm just bringing what I do to it. You know, so it's different for everybody you write with. If you're writing for their record and they're already established, you got to come up with something that's them. And you just bring what, you know, your little perks, what you do well to the session. But you don't drive the session if you're writing with Madonna or somebody, whoever. You know what I mean? You're not driving. You're sort of, you know, you're driving. Let me just, you just tell me which way we going.
When you were playing with Roger, did you get to do the windmill?
Oh, I probably did it just because I'm an asshole.
Right. That's what you got. You got it. If you're going to fucking play it.
Yeah.
A Who song, you got to do that.
Well, when I was that 16-year-old kid,
yeah,
when we were into The Who, we would play Who songs. I was wearing suspenders like he wore, like, and the kids are all right. You know, like I had an SG and I was doing windmills.
Hell yeah.
You know, I didn't know who I was. I wasn't anybody yet. I was just this kid, right? But Pete Townsend, I was talking to not only Roger about this, but friends of mine, unique guitar players. Jeff Beck, like most of the, like you talk to 9 out of 10 people that are around my demographic, they'll say Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page, Paul Kossoff, you know, Jeff Beck. This, we all play a little bit. You could hear a little bit of those guys in all of us. You could be in denial, but you're going to hear it. You can hear Clapton riffs or Jimmy Page riffs on my records. Right?
Sure.
They turn into mine because I turn them inside out sometimes. But we'll get into this. It's very rare to hear somebody play like Jeff Beck or Pete Townsend because they came from a different place. Pete Townsend played, you know, I can't even explain it. Like his leads were rhythm.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's a completely different place.
Yeah, these guys invented it.
Exactly. And Jimmy Page, I mean, Jeff Beck, thought from the other side of his brain, like his leads or like, you know, the stuff he did with Truths, with Rod Stewart, that's one thing. Then he started to get bored with that and he started to play differently and he started not using a pick and he started using a Strat with the bar.
Right.
And his playing got into something else. It's different from when he was with the Yardbirds. So I guess my point is like those two guys are unique in their playing. A lot of the other ones I'm mentioning, Mike Bloomfield, right? Mm-hmm. All had their beginnings with the blues, right?
Of course.
Like they took what Hound Dog Taylor did, Muddy Waters, and turned it into this electric stuff and added their own seasoning. But you can hear you hear the blues in everybody's guitar playing.
Absolutely.
And Paul Kossoff, I was just thinking about this yesterday. Paul Kossoff had the best vibrato, right? Vibrato.
Yeah.
Right. But you also listen to Angus Young has that same vibrato from AC/DC, you know, and other people have slow vibrato, you know, and then there's Albert King. That's a whole other freaking podcast. My favorite blues guitar player. For instance, he played one note 15 different ways. He did one note, but he would bend it 15 different ways in between. He'd be in between the two notes, you know?
Yeah. What I like about your music is you've distilled all this and you're a rock and roller. You've taken this and put it in.
It's different than rock.
What's that?
It's different than rock. I'm a rock and roll guy.
Yeah. You are a rock and roll guy. Yeah. Yeah.
Ain't no rock without the roll.
No, this is a harken back to this is the Chuck Berry is the root of it.
And I say, when people ask me, what is your mission statement for these records? I wanted to be the music that excited me when I was 14. So I'm not afraid to do a nod to Jimmy Page or to this one or that one. I do it on purpose.
Yeah.
You hear little bits. I mean, I just did a Steve Marriott scream. I try to do one on every album on one of these new songs called You Get One Life is what it's called. You get one life. And I do a scream at the end is completely Marriott.
Yeah, you gotta picture.
Yeah, I know his riffs backwards and forwards, not in his key, but I know his riffs. His voice was way higher than mine.
We're talking about the recovery troubadour stuff, which ties into exactly what we're talking about, which is the rock and roll music that you grew up with, but you put it into the context over the last 10 years with lyrics dealing with your recovery. And you've spent a lot of time over the years assisting people in recovery and being a part of that. You talk a little about those two records, Sobering Times and Clean Getaway.
So my friend Richie Supa, who played with Aerosmith for a little while when Joe Perry was doing his thing, but he wrote amazing, co-wrote amazing, Chip Away the Stones, you know, and a ton of other songs with other artists. He lives in Florida. He got into recovery just a little after me. And he said, I'm doing a recovery show here in Fort Lauderdale. You want to come do I Love Rock and Roll, play some blues? He had a song called In the Rooms. I said, yeah, great. So I never did it before, right? I never combined the things. I played and I had people coming over to me afterwards saying, I grew up on your music. That's so amazing. You're in recovery. I'm in recovery. Or my brother's struggling or this happened or that. And I said, Yeah, that's interesting. Now, maybe I could help you somehow. Maybe I could, you know, I got some wiggle room in the music business where I could sort of do some stuff with recovery. Come back to New York. I write a song with Richie by phone called Broken. Broken is a Place. It's on the Clean Getaway record. Last song. And I put it online. I can't remember where I put it. YouTube, somewhere. I started getting messages from people around the world saying how the lyrics helped them. Okay. Maybe I should write a second one. Anyway, so that process went on. I wrote like 5 songs. I knew somebody from these. I started doing these recovery gigs with an all-star band that, for charity. So I met some people from a treatment facility that was from Florida, but they had a few in New York, in Jersey. I said, what if I came to your place and did a recovery music group? Great. Started doing that. And every time I finished, the reaction was amazing. I only had 5-6 songs. And I would tell my story a little bit. Every time I finished, somebody would say to me, where do I get this stuff, this music? How can I take it home? So I don't know. Could procrastinate. Finally, I did the Clean Getaway record. See? And then what I did is I would take a stack of them. And when I would do another treatment facility, I would bring a stack of them and give them to the clients in treatment. That's how that started. I kept writing. And then I was in that mindset of recovery songs. So that's the sobering. And I started writing for Sobering Times, which was not going to be Sobering Times, but I just couldn't write anything but recovery songs. That's where Sobering Times came from. Cut to this record. I said, I don't want to, I've got enough sober recovery songs for now. I tried to consciously not write those songs, except for Luann, which I talked about before. So I just became this recovery troubadour guy, I guess somebody called me. And before COVID, I was going all over the country doing these recovery music groups. And hopefully I could start it up again, just playing those two records, not all the songs, because some of them are too electric to play acoustic. I would do an hour. And so it would be like 7 songs and talking. And I would do, I do a couple of cover songs too. I did The Bottle Let Me Down by Merle Haggard. That's on the Sobering Times record. What else did I do? I did 1 or 2 cover songs that had to do with that, with recovery. And that was, I was completely happy. Like that was fabulous. Like I just go into, and what makes it the best is that all these years later, from people that I played to 5 years ago, I will still open up Facebook and there's a message from some cat that I played to at a place in New Jersey, Turning Point Treatment Facility, says, I still listen to and names a song and it still helps me stay sober. So what more can you ask for as a recovery guy and as a songwriter? I mean, as a songwriter, that's it. People are getting something from the songs, right? We're here to make people laugh, cry, and think. And dance.
Well, amazing, amazing story, Ricky. And I'm excited to hear the new music that you have coming out. And you think maybe there's going to be a record at some point?
No, not is there going to be. There's going to be.
There is a record.
Yeah.
When is there going to be a record?
Hopefully, I'm going to hand it in by the end of April. I'm working really hard. I've only had a few to work on.
Great.
If I hand it in, got to do the cover, the whole business. I know what it's called already, but I'm not going to say it yet. And come out late fall. I mean, I don't know, man. It depends. You know, the problem is how long it takes to make vinyl these days.
Yeah.
Because there's not a lot of plants. One thing I want to specifically mention, besides the fact is people should go to rickybird.com. There's plenty of cool stuff on there. There's tons and tons of pictures in the photo gallery of my whole career, of all fun stuff. So if you want to see some of that cool stuff, like me playing with McCartney at the Rock Hall in Ringo. But me and Marriott, you know, all this great fun stuff. There's a store there where those two records are. All the new music, it gives you the links to, you know, get the new songs that are on Wicked Cool. All kinds of stuff. Sign up to my email so you could be informed if I'm coming to your town. I mean, am I going to put a band together? Oh, God, please, no. But you never know. I'll never say no. I want people, and I'm asking people, to be patrons of the arts. It's a different music business we live in. Streaming is fabulous. But for artists like myself, you know, small records, we put out records to just keep it going, keep people happy and put out music because that's what we do. We need people to download the music. See?
Yeah.
That's direct money that helps us keep making music.
Right.
Nobody's getting rich. It's about continuing the process of making music for rock and roll fans. Streaming is ridiculous because the amount of streams you need to get anything out of that. Yeah, the Beyonce and Taylor, those people, they make tons of money from streaming. But for artists like myself that put these records out, I mean, you need billions of streams, bro.
That's right.
But if you go right now and download one of the four singles, that money goes straight to the artist or to the record company who's, you know, you split it, whatever it is. So I'm asking people, I'm so thrilled you love what I do now, but we need you to actually put your money where your mouth is. Like, if you love rock and roll, then buy the music. Once they started giving it away for free, it was the death of anything. Now bands make their money from touring and selling merch. Am I going to do that? I don't know. I can't imagine myself doing it. Like Jones going back on the road for the summer, right? Big tour. I don't think I could, I don't think I would want to do that at this point. I like being home. I like recording. I love writing. I love going to the gym. I love hanging out with my family. You know, I don't think I could do that, that massive tour thing these days. Would I like to put a band together and do special gigs? You know, like, let's say play the city wineries around the country.
Sure.
Oh, that'd be fun.
Yeah.
Or do an acoustic tour or something like that. Look, but not months and months. It's just, I'm done.
Well, I second that. Everybody should download, support. If you have merchandise, buy the merchandise. This is
how. It adds up, you know. I know it's 99 cents for a single, but, you know, and when I get the vinyl, man, buy the vinyl.
Absolutely.
Everybody loves vinyls, you know.
Do.
Yeah, exactly. I just found every time I go to the studio, there's a secondhand shop, like blocks, and I always wind up stopping there. Or on a break, we go there. And the other day I picked up, Gene Pitney vinyl, perfect condition.
Love it.
Dion's greatest hit, like every Dion song. Dion's a friend of mine, right? We took out like $3.
Yeah.
The Joe Cocker record. Remember his face on the front, the big face?
I can't stand the rain.
Yeah, it had Bird on a Wire. She Came In Through the Bathroom Window.
Yeah,
when I was a kid, it was great.
Oh, it's that first, the very first one where it's the drawing.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. That's
What else? What was the other one I came? Oh my God, the Chambers Brothers, Time Has Come Today album.
Oh, yeah. So good.
So like every time I go there, I come home with a bag and Carol goes, what'd you get? Here's my... Here's my take today.
I love it. Love hearing that.
Yeah, man. And I just always check to see. Like, I saw a record I really wanted. Because I lost all my, we had Hurricane Sandy here, and that's a whole other conversation.
Did it affected you?
Oh, God, we lost half the house. Yep, this where I'm sitting now, the water was up to the ceiling. I'm in the basement. My studio.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I lost both of us. Carol lost all her records and stuff. But so I'm just picking, I don't want to go crazy, but I'm picking specific.
Yeah. Like what's the one you wanted? What were you about?
Well, I saw it there and I was excited. It might have been the first Jimi Hendrix record, something, which was the first record I ever bought.
Yeah.
I remember I went and I bought Jimi Hendrix Experience and the first Monkees album on the same day. So what that really tells my story right there.
Yeah, that's great.
But they had it, dude, and I pulled it out of the scratch. I was so bummed out. You know, you got to pull it out. It's a good condition.
Totally. Totally.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, Rich, dude, I'm still a rock and roll guy. I got my guitar, 12 string. There's my baseball cards.
Oh yeah.
From when you were a kid.
Yeah.
Right there.
You got the old Yankees.
All my comic books and rock magazines are right over there.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I never got past 12.
No, neither have I. I'm dealing with the same thing. The baseball
cards.
Which
is a problem.
The vinyl.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You gotta have stuff that brings you back to that.
Yeah, they're not.
You gotta be an adult. See, recovery made me an adult, but you gotta have a place to walk into where you could be 12 again, because it's a very harsh world out there now. Yeah, you gotta take a moment and go back to being that kid. And me being that kid is going to Yankee Stadium, getting a couple of francs with my kid or whoever. My daughter, thankfully, and her boyfriend both love baseball, Yankees. You know, sitting there for 3 hours or even sit down. I'm very happy to sit on my couch and watch games. You know, I watch every single Yankee game if I'm here. And that takes me back.
Yeah.
See, and it's important to go back sometimes, you know, because it's so cutthroat now, you know, and everything is more. I got to get through. I got to do this. I got to do that. And just to sit in B12 and take your cards out, you know, I open that book and I just go through them and I just look at them. Oh, look, Whitey Ford, you know, look, you know, all the years.
Yeah, you know. That's really cool.
And I hope I never change.
Amen. I hope you don't.
Except for my white hair.
All right, Ricky. Well, thank you so much for the time. Thank you for your contribution to everything in music history.
I appreciate your asking good questions.
Thank you.
You know, people out there, just keep supporting rock and roll, man, because there'll come a day where there won't be any rock and roll.
Yeah.
If people can't afford to make the music, there's not going to be any. You're going to be listening to Journey records for the rest of your life, which is not a bad thing.
No, but
I don't want to piss off any Journey fans. Yeah.
All right, Ricky. All right, brother. Thanks, brother. I'll see you soon. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Legends Podcast by All Day Vinyl. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate it, share it, subscribe, and follow us and check us out at All Day Vinyl on Instagram and YouTube.